Money, Riches, and Wealth is sponsored by the Financial Consulate.
Say you don't need no diamond rings, and I'll be satisfied. Tell me that you want the kind of things the money just can't buy. I don't care too much for money. Money can buy me love.
This is Talk Radio 680 WCBM. Time now for Money, Riches, and Wealth. Here's your host, Drew Tignanelli.
This is Drew Tignanelli here, Money, Riches, and Wealth. And we are not on a quote-unquote open show, but we are going to take calls tonight. But our calls are only going to be about business and business tax planning and business owners from a legal point of view. And I've got with me tonight Sean Olavia of Levin & Gann here in Towson. Actually, we use them personally as our attorneys. And I asked Sean if you wanted to come on the radio and talk about some of the legal issues that business owners deal with on a day-to-day basis. And what are some of the hot topics that are going around? And because there are an amazing amount of business owners that listen to WCBM, and especially Money, Riches, and Wealth. So we wanted to get Sean on and talk about some of these issues. Sean, how are you?
I am wonderful, Drew.
It's good to have you tonight.
Thank you. It's good to be here. It's exciting.
Yeah, well, you know, there's at least two people out there listening. Maybe your wife and my wife might be listening. I know my wife doesn't listen, so there's only one wife out there listening. My wife hasn't listened in about 10 years. I think she listened the first week and said, yeah, you did a nice job, but it's pretty boring to me. You know?
Yeah, so. I think my wife will be dealing with the kids and say, oh, was that tonight?
Anyway, we're talking about business owners, business planning. There's tons of topics in the business realm. You know, if you're a business owner, you're dealing with all kinds of things that have legal ramifications. You're dealing with buy-sell agreements. You know, if something happens to one of the owners, mm-hmm. you're talking about retirement plans. You're talking about asset protection. You're talking about, strategies to develop your business long-term, mergers, mm-hmm. acquisitions. All these things are things that you might need an attorney to help you with.
Absolutely. And even the simple things like entering into a lease agreement or entering into a contract to purchase equipment.
Most people, though, Sean, just sign those things.
Yes, they do. And then they realize there's a problem, and then they call a lawyer.
A year or two later, and they call, Sean, this guy's giving me a hard time saying I still owe him for the next 2 years of the lease I signed. What the heck is his problem?
Yeah.
And you say, well.
Well, did we look at the lease? What lease?
So anyway, you got all these different issues. So we are going to take calls from our listeners if they have a business issue that they want to ask Sean a question on, you know, like the leases or a contract they've signed or a retirement plan or asset protection. They're worried that something they might do in the future. Now, if somebody actually has a liability coming against them, there's not a lot. I mean, there are things you might be able to do, but there's not a lot you can do. We're going to talk more about this, but
absolutely. There are things you can do depending on how far along that liability is.
Potential liability.
And it depends on notice, and it also depends on a lot of other factors. It's very specific as to what you can do, but I always tell clients there's always something you can do. It just may or may not work. And if you're already stepped in it, it might be worth it to take a chance and do something.
You know, there's also other issues, you know, like what is the entity type that you're currently using? And you know what? We do a lot of financial physicals for business owners, and I'd say 25% of the time I find that the entity type of the business owner is incorrect.
Absolutely. And I'd say it's more than 25%
of the time. I'm being generous, Sean.
Yeah.
25% of the time.
And my favorite is when people say, oh, I'm an S Corp, so I can't be an LLC. And most people confuse S Corp's tax designations for entities versus the state designation. So the federal government may say that this is how it's taxed, but the states say, no, as a matter of law, this is the type of entity that you are.
So you're an LLC, taxed as an S-Corp.
That's correct. And most people don't know you can do that. And they're like, oh, I can do that? I'm like, yeah, of course. And it gives you all these protections. And most people don't know that.
And the other thing is that there's a filing requirement to say, I want to be taxed as an S-Corp. And some people think that they've done that, but their actual professionals never did it.
Absolutely.
That happens all the time.
And my favorite is the professionals, the accountant says the lawyer did it, and the lawyer says the accountant did it. So every time I do one, there's always an email saying, are we filing this or is the accountant filing this? And we make sure it gets done.
So anyway, if you want to call in and ask a question on business planning, business legal issues, 410-922-6680, 410-922-6680. If you want to call in and ask a question on a business issue, and Sean will do his best to help you answer that question, or I should, you know, we'll both try to, you know, help you answer that question. So Sean, let's just start off with, you got a business owner and they are entering into legal agreements, and they do it all the time.
Absolutely.
They do a lease agreement for an office or something of that sort. What are the things that you're looking at when somebody comes to you and says, here's my lease, what do you think?
So with a lease, you're always looking at what potential liability a tenant has. So typically when I'm representing a business owner who is not a landlord, but a business owner who's a tenant, I'm looking at the liability they have, what increases in the CAM costs or common area maintenance, and what other hidden fees the landlord has built into the lease. In addition to that, you're always looking at a hazardous materials provision, because landlords sort of put it in there that you become responsible for any hazardous material that may have been by a prior tenant. So you're always looking at, has the landlord put something in there that makes you responsible for more than you really should be?
You know, and you got the operating expense, and you know that's going to be divvied up amongst everyone, et cetera, et cetera. You get that. You get that.
Absolutely.
Where at the end of the year they come, oh, by the way, you owe us an extra $8,000. And you're like, really? Why?
Exactly.
And you think, well, it's here in the lease. We're going to take the operating expense. We're going to divide it amongst everyone. We just projected what we thought it was going to be. But what is an operating expense?
Right. Well, an operating expense includes – it's usually defined in the lease, number one. But
that's the problem.
Yes, it can be a problem. But what I find – so it includes, you know, the lights for the hallways, the cleaning crew, the maintenance, the painting, all the things that that are taken that are outside of your actual premises within the general building that you're in. But what I find with CAM costs, with the common area maintenance, that usually landlords do not put a right to audit or to even ask what are the CAM costs. You just have to pay it. So if you don't have the right to ask the landlord, gee, can I get an itemization? They don't have to provide you one. And guess what? You have to pay the full bill. So when I get a call from a business owner and says, hey, my CAM costs went up by, you know, $25,000 this year. What gives us to send me your lease? I look at the lease and I say, we can ask him for the documentation, but he doesn't have to provide it.
Right.
So that's always fun. And sometimes landlords build in capital improvements, which they shouldn't, in CAM costs, like replacing a roof. That shouldn't be part of the CAM cost, but
Okay, hold on with me, Sean. We're going to come right back to this. But if you want to get on and ask a question about any legal issue for your business, 410-922-6680, 410-922-6680. Right now, I got to go to traffic. We'll leave it here, and we'll go to traffic. Take it away, traffic. This is Drew Tignanelli, president of the Financial Consulate and host of Money, Riches, and Wealth. So often a radio listener calls me saying, I've been listening to you for years and have been meaning to call. When they come in for their comprehensive financial physical, they say, I wish I had done this years ago. If you've been meaning to call and meet with us, then do not wait. Call now to learn more about our trademark financial physical. The financial physical is designed to be a comprehensive second opinion analyzing all your goals and objectives. Are you maximizing tax efficiencies? Will you be able to maintain your lifestyle in retirement? Is your portfolio properly allocated, or just a few of the many parts of the physical? The best part of our service is you get to see the final product before you decide if you want to pay for it. We do this to assure you we are not selling product, and we guarantee the physical to be truly beneficial. Do not wait any longer. Call 410-823-7283. That's 410-823-SAFE, or visit us online at financialphysical.com.
Now back to more of Money, Riches, and Wealth on Talk Radio 680 WCBM.
Crane's Clearwater Revival. See, I know these things all the time, and, you know, you keep thinking I'm not going to get it, you know? 100% so far in last 10 years. So, you haven't stumped me yet, so what the heck's the big deal there, Chris? Anyway, we're here on a sort of open show. We're talking about business owners. We're talking about legal issues with business owners. And first, Sean and I started out with just dealing with leases and so forth, and the legal things that you got to look for when you're signing a lease. And there's a lot of legal issues. I'll give you a funny one with me, Sean. We went to a building up on International Circle, and we signed a lease, and it had an operating expense thing in it. And so they sent me the operating expense, and they actually had to break it down and show us exactly what they were charging. They told me that I owed them some obscene amount of money. And I'm thinking, what the heck? You know, I mean, how could they be this far off? And, you know, and so forth. So they sent me their spreadsheet, and I took the spreadsheet, and I found that the spreadsheet had all kinds of mistakes on it. And they said that what was $10 a foot, when I calculated it and did it all and figured out what was going on, it was actually only about $6.72. You say, well, how could a spreadsheet be that off? Well, it was all done manually. The guy went in and he just used the spreadsheet, but he didn't use any formulas. He calculated it all by hand and made some huge mistake on one big item, and it popped the thing up. So, you know, one thing that people ought to be doing is auditing those expense things.
Absolutely.
You know, because and we had one when, you know, actually with that building, for the first 4 years, we found major mistakes. 4 years in a row. Not just simple mistakes, major mistakes. But in the building we're in right now, we had the company came and told us we owed them a lot of money. But the reason was, is what you were talking about a little while ago, they had to replace the elevators. And they were telling us that we had to pay for that because it was an operating expense. But we proved to them beyond the – we're accountants. What do you expect? You expect us to sit over there and roll over and say that an elevator is an operating expense? Well, they said, well, we Section 199'd it. I said, I don't care if you Section 199. It's still a capital expense. They finally had to agree and take it off of the operating expense thing, you know? So it's funny. You got to watch these things.
Landlords love to throw things in. And the sad part is maybe some tenants catch it, but if you got like seven or eight tenants in one complex, my guess is about half of them just stroke a check and move on, and they don't look at that kind of stuff.
No.
And a lot of times in a lease, the other thing that I think trips up people is they'll have provisions that say if you have more than one default, you've got to now pay 3 months in advance rent. So people all of a sudden get a bill from the landlord that say, hey, you owe me 3 months rent. They're like, for what? Oh, you were 2 days late on one payment, right? You know, so it's all those sort of fun little issues that people don't really consider. The other big thing I'd say whenever signing a lease, probably the biggest issue is a landlord throws in a provision, whether it's obvious or not, that you are personally guaranteeing the lease.
Yeah.
You know, that's always something that if you're in a business and you have your entity structure, your LLC, your corporation, your partnership, you should not be personally guaranteeing a lease ever unless there's a good reason for it.
If your business isn't proven to be exceptionally profitable, then I used to do that in the early days of my company. But, you know, nowadays with the profitability of our firm and they asked me to personally guarantee their lease, I said, I'm going to look for another building.
Exactly.
You know, it's ridiculous. So.
Yeah. And some landlords put it in that it doesn't say as a guarantee. There's just a provision that says anybody who's signing this agreement, even on behalf of an entity, they're also agreeing to personally. I've seen that provision. I'm not. I mean, some landlords are cute. Now, ultimately, would a judge find that to be enforceable? Let's hope not, but one never knows.
So let's move on to a different topic, mergers and acquisitions.
Okay.
So many business owners are selling their business to somebody. The originator of the company is doing a succession plan with somebody
Absolutely.
Else. This is a critical area because you've got lots of moving parts. Not only do you have the legal agreement where there's all kinds of provisions in there, but you also have all the tax issues
absolutely.
That are going on. And it has to be thought out extremely carefully.
It absolutely does. And a large part of my practice is dealing with mergers and acquisitions, M&As. And I find that most people, when you start to sell your business, the most successful talk to their lawyer before they start entertaining any offers or talk to their other employees that may be buying the business from them to sort of formulate the plan ahead of time, because there are a lot of things that you can do tax-wise if you do it before you start that discussion so that you can structure it in a certain way. Then if you're going to sell it to your employees, there are lots of tax strategies, ESOPs, and other specific tax planning items that can help you if you're going one direction or another. The other big thing is timing, I think, for sale of a business, because, you know, if you're selling your business and you're, you know, you happen to be closing October or November, why not push it off into January so that you can defer the tax for an entire year? There are all these sorts of very important planning aspects of it. And then what are you going to provide? Are you going to insist on cash up front? Are you going to finance the purchase price? That's a very big issue that a lot of business owners don't really necessarily think about. They think, hey, if this guy's giving me all this money, he's agreeing that my business is – he's paying me more than I think it's worth. And business owners don't really consider that, gee, if I'm not getting the cash up front, I'm taking the risk that he's not going to be successful with my business.
Right, right. So let me just tell our listeners, we're on an open show. If you want to ask any questions about legal issues and so forth, you want to call in, whether it's a lease or whether it's a merger or acquisition or whether it's a retirement plan question or asset protection. You know, Sean's here if you want to ask a question. 410-922-6680, 410-922-6680. So, Sean, you know that when you're doing a merger and acquisition, again, there are many moving parts. First, mm-hmm. you got to negotiate what's the price. But then you got these tax issues. Now, here's where it gets interesting. When you're typically going to sell a business, and I'm talking about minor businesses under $50 million, okay?
Yeah.
And a lot of them are going to be $2 million, $1 million, something of that sort. But normally, those deals are going to be done what's called an asset purchase.
Correct.
And that's a big difference between a stock purchase and an asset purchase. So just give us a little bit on that and why that's so important to understand.
So from a buyer's perspective, it's always going to be an asset purchase agreement, asset purchase deal, because you don't want the liabilities that follow the seller. So if you're a buyer and you buy the stock of a business or you buy the ownership interest of a business, any liability, known or unknown, goes to the new owner.
Correct.
Whereas if you buy the assets, that liability doesn't transfer.
Right. And that liability could be to a 2-year-old who has 18 more years to sue you.
Absolutely.
And you bought that corporation. You got 18 years until that 2-year-old is going to finally default and say, OK, I'm not going to sue you.
Yeah.
But that could be a long time. you may not even
time.
Know what your former owner did to the 2-year-old.
Absolutely. So. So I would say in my practice, less than 2% of my deals end up being stock purchase agreements. Now, where you have a large VC, a venture capitalist that's buying a company, sometimes they insist on a stock purchase for various reasons, and you've got to accommodate them.
They're going to do that because of tax purposes. There are some ways
absolutely.
That they can do a tax deal that could be tax-free if the deal
absolutely.
Works out profitable, but it has to be a C-Corp, and that's why they're going to do the tax,
absolutely.
The stock sale.
Absolutely. So typically if you say we're going to do a stock sale instead of an asset sale, that's usually a bad thing on tax-wise for the seller, but a good thing tax-wise for the buyer. So typically what ends up happening is you tell the buyer, hey, you got to increase the purchase price a little bit to cover the additional tax I'm going to have to pay.
Hold on with me. We've got to take another traffic break. We're on an open show, sort of. We're talking only business legal issues. And if you want to call and ask a question, 410-922-6680, 410-922-6680. And lines are open right now. I got to go to traffic. We'll be right back. Money, Riches, and Wealth.
Back to more of Money, Riches, and Wealth on Talk Radio 680 WCBM.
All right, we're back, Money, Riches, and Wealth, and we're with Shauna Lavia, and we're talking about business legal issues. And so one of them we've been talking about is leases and signing leases and all the garbage that could be in there that you have to weed out. And mergers and acquisitions we're on right now and talking about. If you want to call in and ask question, 410-922-6680. And I'm gonna go to Mark in Ellicott City in a second. But Sean, just tell everyone what you were saying before the during the break about the Warren Act.
Right. So one of the things when you're selling your business or you're buying a business is employees. That's always a big issue that people tend to forget about. We have all sorts of laws in Maryland and all over that say that if you have the Warren Act says if you have more than 50 employees. And they're not going to have a job once the business sells. You have to give them notice. You have to give them certain information. And
well, before the deal is finalized.
A few days before the deal is finalized, yeah. So those are a lot of things that people miss. And also, if you're buying a business, keep in mind that even if you do it as an asset purchase deal, sometimes employee liabilities can potentially go on to the buyer.
Right. So let's go to Mark in Ellicott City. Mark, how can we help you?
Okay, I have a medical practice that I'm going to give to or sell to my son. And the two scenarios, I would just not sell it, and he would take a good percentage of the profits and just pay me, say I own the building, would pay me rent.
Mm-hmm. Right. See, you know, this is a good question he's asking because I have a lot of doctors who dentists who selling to their child, and I normally always recommend the child start their own entity and then buy the business from dad as opposed to dad turning over the entity to them.
Absolutely.
So go ahead, Mark, ask your question.
So I was just wondering, or could I just sell it to him for a dollar and then he would and work out the arrangements on monthly payments forever, you know, for amortized for 10 years or something.
So there are a couple issues there. One is if you just sell a business for less than full consideration and the government ever looks at that, because you're selling it to a child, the government can come back and say, hey, that was a gift because you sold an asset for less than full consideration. So you want to be careful if you do transfer business to a child for, you know, for a dollar for less than full consideration, that it's documented that you're getting something for it and it's not a gift, or you want to at least get an idea of what that value is. As far as your first concept of selling the, basically him starting up his own practice and having a rent payment sort of make up the purchase price, that's absolutely a decent way to sort of start, and then the patients would just sort of transfer it to him because he'd be in the same space as you. You get the same sort of deductions that you have as a landlord. So tax-wise, that would be fine. It all sort of depends on what type of medical practice you have and are these, you know, how are the patients coming in? If it's something that he's literally going to turn over to you, it becomes a little bit more complicated, but if it's just, you know, new patients coming in, like Drew said, you set up a new entity and those patients just sort of migrate to him without any issue.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with that. Yep.
What about the tax consequences? Say that it was just the value of it and I sell it to my son. Is there a gain? How does that all work?
So depends on what he's buying.
Right. It depends on what he's buying. It depends also how you're set up. Are you a corporation? Are you an S corp?
I'm an S corp.
So you're an S corp. So if you sell it, you're going to have capital gain on the assets that you sell. So for example, let's say the purchase price is $100,000, And let's say you allocate $20,000 to the equipment, the furnitures, fixtures, and equipment. That's all going to be most likely ordinary income to you because you have likely fully depreciated that those
assets.
You have
to recapture the depreciation, right?
Right.
Taxed at 25% at least. Go
correct,
ahead.
Correct. And so anything above that, so goodwill is how, you know, us practitioners like to play with the purchase price because goodwill is a capital asset to you, to the seller, and it is deductible typically on a 15-year amortization to the buyer. So typically when you – in the example where you have a $100,000 purchase price, you'd want to say that $80,000 to $90,000, as much as you can reasonably say, is goodwill because that – again, you're paying capital gains rates as opposed to ordinary income. So these are definitely questions you want to, you know, sit down and talk more.
And normally with a father and son, you're not going to have to worry about not to compete agreements.
Exactly.
You know? But it is an issue that you have to think about.
Absolutely. And you can use the goodwill and you can use a non-compete to get a better tax advantage on the sale.
Yeah. Mark, you just need to make sure you got a good accountant, good lawyer to think that out with you, you know, before you transfer it. Okay, buddy?
All right, thanks so much.
All right, good question. I mean, you know, you're talking about transferring a business in a minute or two.
Yeah.
You know, Dan in Owings Mills, how can we help you, Dan?
Good evening, gentlemen. I'm looking at transferring a company in the next few years through a vehicle of ESOP.
Right.
Uh-huh.
And my question is, it seems like, at least preliminarily, the people I've talked to, they value my company based off of a multiplier times EBITDA.
Right.
My question, though, is I have significant amount of retained earnings in the company. How does that get factored into a value of the corporation?
So let's ask you a couple quick questions, okay? So what type of entity are you, Dan?
Professional.
A professional. And the general revenue of the company, $5 million, $10 million, $50
million? About $55
million. Okay.
So typically the retained earnings will be factored in their multiples. So they'll in valuing your company for purposes of the ESOP, they're going to look at the retained earnings and how much money you've left in the business. Now, sometimes you may want to do a partial sale of your business to get you may want to, in essence, take out the retained earnings before you do the ESOP because it ends up typically speaking, I can't say specifically for you, but typically speaking, the retained earnings will get lost in that purchase price with the ESOP. So you typically want to take that out before you actually do the ESOP sale to the employees that are taking over the business.
Are you taxed as a partnership or a sole proprietor or as an S-Corp?
I'm an S-Corp, so I've already paid the taxes on my retained
Right. But and Sean is right. You want to take a lot of that cash out before the ESOP comes in and values it.
But is there a ratio that will tell me when I'm, quote, undercapitalized and that will begin to hurt the multiplier?
I doubt it.
Not usually, but the people that are helping you go through this can sit down and do those numbers with you.
Yeah.
They should be the ones sitting down with you and talking to you about that and saying, hey, you know, you should be taking X amount of cash out of your business every year before we do the ESOP. When you do an ESOP, you're typically starting 3 or 4 or 5 years before you actually enter the ESOP. In the best case scenario. Now, I've seen it lots of times where they do it very quickly. But
or they go to a bank and borrow all the money.
Oh, yes,
yeah.
Exactly.
And that's going to be the way. And if Dan wants out totally, that's the way they're going to do it. If Dan, you're going to transition out, they'll do it year by year over a period of time.
Yeah, well, basically, I'm loaning the money back to the ESOP, right? And then they'll be paying me out through the profits, which their profits won't be taxed anymore because it's a legitimate retirement plan.
Sure,
right?
Absolutely. And so are you going to leave the business immediately or are you going to stay with it for a while?
Oh, no, I'm looking at doing this over the next 3 to 5 years.
Yeah, so you'll work as an owner to some degree still and an employee also. More.
That's correct.
Yeah. So, you know, I mean, I think it's a great concept. I'm an ESOP. My company just became an ESOP recently, and it's a great program for the employees and for you if done properly. But be careful. Make sure you do it very professionally. There was just a great legal case where a company got slammed for failure to do it properly and follow all the rules. I mean, they got slammed.
Absolutely. and unfortunately, sometimes if you're not careful on retained earnings and getting the money out of the business, I think the business owners end up getting less than they otherwise should have.
Yep. Dan, hopefully that's helpful to you, my friend.
One quick question.
Yep.
Is it any advantage for me to make my residence in Florida prior to the sale?
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
So, well before you go to Florida. Well before. Don't let Peter Francho know either, you know. And make sure you do that legitimately. Take your heart to Florida with you. Don't leave it here in Maryland. All right, my friend?
Very good. Thank you for your help.
All right. We got to go to traffic. We'll be right back. Money, Riches, and Wealth. This is Drew Tignanelli, host of Money, Riches, and Wealth, and president of the Financial Consulate. Are you looking for a professional financial advisor that you can trust and help you through all stages of life? Having a team of comprehensive personal financial advisors and CPAs gives us the ability to help you prepare your tax return, strategize to help you minimize tax liability, help you visualize and reach your retirement goals, and help guide you in every other facet of personal financial planning. We demonstrate these abilities every Wednesday night on our radio show, Money, Riches, and Wealth. Have you been wanting a second opinion? Then consider our trademark service, the Financial Physical. We guarantee if you don't come away from your Financial Physical with a sense of immense value, then there will be absolutely no charge. Call 410-823-7283 to speak with me and the team of comprehensive personal financial advisors and CPAs. That is 410-823-SAVE or go online to financialphysical.com. That's financialphysical.com.
Now back to more of Money, Riches, and Wealth on Talk Radio 680 WCBM.
We're back, Money, Riches, and Wealth. These last two songs were too easy to even suggest. I mean, it's like insulting my music intelligence here. So anyway, we're back with Money, Riches, and Wealth. And, you know, Dan had a great question about selling his business and doing it to an ESOP and so forth. But at the end, Sean, he brings up the concept of should he move to Florida before he does it. And the answer is absolutely yes, number one. But I want to also bring up a second thing before you answer. Also, a ding. A Delaware incomplete non-grantor trust, where you bring the income to a trust which is not going to pay state income tax.
That's correct.
So you got two different ways that you can get out of, but it's got to be done perfectly, legally, not in any way, shape, or form trying to fudge the rules, because that's the worst thing you can do.
Absolutely. And you want to make sure it's documented and done ahead of time. But just to talk about both of those concepts are...
Let's start with moving to Florida.
Moving to Florida.
How do you prove that your heart's now in Florida, no longer here in Maryland?
So establishing residency in Florida is basically a 20 or 26 factors examination that the Maryland Comptroller would look at. And they have actually published, if you go into Google and you type in Maryland release number 32, Maryland admin release 30, if it's 32 or 36, the state comptroller publishes the guidelines that they look at. The biggest ones are voter registration, where are you registered to vote, where is your driver's license. Where for older people, and I'm just being honest, they look at where are your main doctors, you know, where is your family. What size house, assume you own a house in Maryland and Florida and you want to maintain both residences, what's the size of your house in Maryland versus Florida? And if you've got a, you know, one-bedroom condo in Florida and you've got a nine-bedroom home in Maryland, they're going to say, gee, it's not really Maryland, or Florida's not really where your heart is. It's really in Maryland.
Most people think, Sean, that it's strictly, I wasn't in Maryland as many days as I was in Florida. That's a factor, though.
It is.
It is one of the factors, and
Correct.
It is an important one. It's
Correct.
A very important one,
Absolutely.
But it is not the only one.
It is not the only one. It's actually 182 days outside of the state of Maryland. So you'd have to be outside of Maryland for 182 days. And where some people get tripped up in that math is where you leave to go on vacation. So if you're going to go on a week vacation to Europe and you leave from Maryland, apparently, according to the comptroller, those days are counted as Maryland days. I don't know why, but if you leave from Florida or JFK, it's not. But again, I'm not going to get into the common sense of that. But it is that's definitely something that you want to think about. In, you know, there are other states besides Florida that you can look at. Delaware is another good state people look at in addition to doing the ding.
We're going to get to the ding in a second, but let's stick with teaching people how to prove, according to the comptroller, that you've taken your heart, because that's, I'm not just saying this jokingly, it's where did your heart go?
Absolutely.
In New York, they actually had a case when the dog was still in New York, and even though the guy was 8 months in Texas, because the dog stayed in New York, he actually wrote an email that they used against him in the court case that said, when I'm ready to bring Buddy to Texas, because I really feel this is home now.
Yeah.
And even though he was 8 months in Texas, because he didn't bring Buddy until that day, New York was able to hammer him for the 2 years before
Absolutely.
That he left Buddy in New York.
Absolutely. So you want, again, the big things are you want to document your days outside of the state. So some people who like to drive, I always say plane tickets are better because you can always keep your stubs and prove that you were out of the state for the requisite number of days. The other thing I like to tell people to do is to keep receipts. So when you live in Florida, you want to have all those receipts for buying food, eating out, buying groceries, buying furniture.
And they monitor your credit card and your cell phone.
Absolutely. If you're audited, you have to submit all that stuff in order to prove that really you were in Florida. I had an interesting case where it really turned on where did the grandchildren come to visit grandma and grandpa. And in that case, I'm not joking. And that was what convinced the agent that, gee, this was really a Florida resident because, you know, for the holidays, everybody was in Florida.
Right. Tell everybody how to get in touch with you, because I'm running out of time. And then what time we have left, we're going to talk about this ding or wing.
Absolutely. So if anybody has any questions, you can shoot me an email or send me or give me a phone call. My phone number is 410-321-4651.
Again, you always have to say it twice.
Yeah. Again, 410-321-4651. You've heard my voicemail.
Right.
My email is ELA, V as in Victor, IA, at LevinGann, that's LEV, V as in Victor, IN, N as in Nancy, GANN, both N's as in Nancy, .com. And I will not say that one twice.
Yeah, but you know, the easy way is just go to LevinGann.com.
Oh, go to the website, yeah.
LevinGann.com and look up for Sean. There's only one Sean in the firm, as far as I remember.
That is still true, yes. Only one Sean. Certainly only one Sean Olavia.
Levin, LevinGann.com. Levin and Gann, that's how you can find Sean. Great law firm. I enjoy working with them myself. But tell everyone real quick, you got about a minute, what is a ding or a wing? I use them a lot myself personally.
Right. So dings, in essence, allow you to transfer your business to a trust. So it has to be an irrevocable trust, which means you can't change it, set up outside of the state, typically in Delaware, in a non-taxable state. And what it allows you to do is once the asset is in there and it's getting the income from the sale of your business, that is now no longer a Maryland income asset because it is taxed outside of the state. Now, the comptroller doesn't necessarily agree on all of this right now. So you really, if you're going to try that concept, you have to talk to a lawyer and your accountant and make sure that you do it correctly.
It's got to be done. Everything's got to be done perfectly legally.
Absolutely.
And you don't try to, you know, fudge anything. Nothing should be fudged in any way, shape, or form. But there are options out there for people who have, because look, it's 9.6% that Maryland wants when somebody sells $1 million worth of business,
yeah,
or more. 9.6% is serious money when you're talking $1 million.
And people don't even realize that Maryland doesn't have a capital gains rate. It's all ordinary in Maryland.
9.6% when you're $1 million
yeah.
dollars of income or more. So
it's a lot.
It's a lot of
on
money.
On top of the Fed.
We got to go. This is Drew Tignanelli saying God bless. What I'd like to do to you, shower.